Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
This week with Health Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about the grace period for medicinal cannabis ending at the start of this month, as well as the End of Life Choice Act, which is scheduled to come into force on November 7th. But I began by asking him about ICU capacity in the face of growing COVID cases. The Prime Minister has said 2 days ago that we could see a doubling of cases in the next 2 weeks. Is ICU prepared for this?
Yeah, so we have to remember too, there might be a doubling of cases, but only a small proportion of cases end up in hospital, and a smaller proportion still end up in ICU. So if you think about currently we have just under 550 active cases in Auckland and Waikato, mainly in Auckland. And of those, 28 of those are in hospital and 5 of those are in ICU. So there might be a doubling of cases, but it doesn't mean to say that hospitals and ICU are going to be overwhelmed. That's it. We've got to be prepared, obviously, to make sure that our ICUs do have capacity and that our hospitals do have capacity, and there's a big chunk of work going on that at the moment. But I'm confident that even if there were a doubling of cases, the health system would be fine.
Well, but in terms of numbers, how much ICU capacity is being used up so far?
Roughly 60%, or 60, I can actually give you the numbers, but it's 66%. So when we think about ICU capacity, and this includes designated ICU wards as well as beds that can that are stood up for ICU level care, so often described as high dependency care. So there's about, we sort of hover between about 325 and 340 of those. It changes from one day to the next across the whole hospital network because of what else is going on in a particular hospital and staffing and what have you. But so of those beds that can be used for ICU level care, roughly two-thirds are being used at the moment. And from one day to the next, we hover between kind of 65 and 70%. So that's about right.
Is that usual?
That's usual, yeah. I get a daily report. At 5 o'clock each day, I get a report on capacity utilisation across our hospital system. And I get specifically ICU utilisation ventilator, because some people in ICU and some people outside of ICU are ventilated. And this the total number of beds across our system and the level of utilisation there. So ICU utilisation tends to hover between sort of 65 and 70%. The total hospital capacity utilisation hovers between about sort of 80 and 85%, and then ventilator capacity is usually under 20%. We have a lot of ventilator capacity, and we have a lot held on reserve in case, in relation to COVID, there is a need for it.
But still, two-thirds of our capacity being used up so far, that isn't a lot of wriggle room unless you have surge capacity.
Yeah, so that it means that at any one time there's about 100 other ICU level beds that could be used. The other thing that is that what we asked the hospital to do from the end of last year was identify what other beds could be converted into ICU level care or HDU care. Because it's not, ICU beds are not just those in a designated ICU ward. It's having the right staff, the right equipment and space available. So the DHBs and the ministry tell me that if they needed to, they could surge up to 550 beds dedicated to that high level of care. Now that would mean you'd cancel all your surgeries, your planned care surgeries, your hip operations and things like that, if you had to. But we could get up to that level of care.
Well, the 550 number is for the entire country, right?
Yeah, well, so are the other numbers. I'm talking about the system as a whole. So you've got your big metropolitan hospital like the ones in Auckland. The one of the challenges we have is the smaller provincial hospitals that only have a small number of designated ICU beds. They can lift that capacity to some degree. But if there were a large outbreak in a provincial centre, it is possible, in fact probably likely, that some patients would have to be transported to other hospitals for care because the smaller hospitals would need to do that.
Okay, out of the 550 beds across the entire system, how many of them are in Auckland?
I couldn't tell you that, to be honest. I can't tell you that at the moment. I mean, if I look at the figures for of the regular kind of roughly between kind of 325 and 340 beds, the number in Auckland are there's about 50 or 60 of those beds just in Auckland. This, surging that up to 550, I think that will probably push it up to over 100.
Okay. Moving on to my second topic of the day, it's on medicinal cannabis. Now, the grace period that allows manufacturers to meet the new safety standards of cannabis medicines ended a while ago at the start of this month. So how many applications made the final cut?
Well, there's still quite a few applications actively under consideration, but there's a total of six products now available in the market, and that's a combination of CBD only products and CBD and THC products. And of the two New Zealand manufacturers who've got their GMP license, they will be putting specific products through the application process or the approval process at the moment. So there'll be more products coming on stream in the next few weeks and months.
Well, but the application process was extended for two periods of 6 months. So it's a total of 18 months, but only six products were approved. That's not a lot, is it?
There's a slight confusion there. So what was extended twice was the exemption period for products in the market having to meet the GMP standard, and whether they are imported or locally manufactured, all products were exempt from meeting that standard for a period of time. We extended it twice because it was taking local importers and manufacturers longer to get up to speak and get the data, all that sort of stuff. But I did for the second extension, which was made at the beginning of the year, earlier in the year, I said this would be the last extension because really everybody's had enough time to get the data they need and get these products sorted out. Some importers got on with it and got their products through the approval process and got it approved. Others have taken much longer, and although they've got applications in, they haven't got the approvals before the exemption has expired, so they can't put those products in the market until they get the approval. So the approval process is a standing process. Anybody can apply for approval of a product at any time, provide the data and all the rest of it, but the exemption for meeting the standard has now expired, so every product on the market now has to meet this standard.
Some of the manufacturers say the standards are way too high. What do you think of that?
We consulted widely with the industry before they were promulgated, and actually the industry said we want the best possible international standard because we want to be able to export. The New Zealand manufacturers in this area want to be able to export because they probably quite rightly see the market in New Zealand isn't going to be that huge, and actually if they want to be commercially viable they need to be able to go into bigger markets, and they would be ones overseas. So they wanted a standard that meant they could export easily. So the standard we've got is an internationally accepted standard. Other countries use it and manufacture according to it. So I don't get this thing that suddenly this is all too hard. It's what the industry wanted when we consulted with them.
Okay, going to my final topic of the day, a little quick touch on the End of Life Choice Act. Now, you said recently the health system is ready to implement the Act. What do you mean by that?
Once the referendum was approved the legislation and it became enacted, it takes effect from the 7th of November this year. A few things had to be put in place. So there's a couple of oversight committees, the regulations had to be put in place, the fees regime for practitioners doing this sort of work had to be put in place. That is all now in place. So there's information on our website. So everything that had to be in place for the legislation to take effect on the 7th of November is now in place, and people who wish to avail themselves of their rights under this legislation from the 7th of November will now be able to do so. There will be practitioners available There's advice available, and the legislation will be workable.
How many medical practitioners have you got on board to implement the End of Life Choice Act?
I understand from the Ministry it's roughly 100 medical practitioners have registered their interest in being a practitioner offering this this sort of assistance and advice. I expect that that'll grow a wee bit. We know that there's mixed views and some strongly held views within the medical fraternity about all this. Some medical practitioners don't agree with it. Others consider it's just part of the dignity of the person and letting them make their choice. But the main thing is that there are practitioners who will be available to assist people who want to exercise their rights under the law.
I remember back during the euthanasia referendum, there was a concern that most of these medical practitioners were concentrated too much in the city, and it would means people living in areas that don't have these kind of services will miss out.
Yeah, I think there's a reasonable distribution of the practitioners who have expressed interest. But we, in the fees regime that we've set up, we've built in the fact that actually some people may need to rely on a medical practitioner who is some distance away. So the transport allowance provisions are, mean that a medical practitioner who has to travel some distance to assist a patient won't be out of pocket.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little. The Wire.